Thanks very much, David. Thanks to the organizers for putting on this great workshop. Some of my favorite topics, so I'm really happy to be here. So today I'm going to talk to you about... So today I'm going to talk to you about some work building on what Stephen talked about earlier in the week, as well as at the end some ongoing work with Thomas and John on subsystem self-correction. And that part is a bit more open-ended, so feel free to interrupt with questions or heckles. Okay. So I just want to start by echoing what Robert was saying in his talk about how much about the how symmetry has given us quite a good lens to look at these different problems in fault tolerance. So topological phases with symmetry have somehow provided us with a nice way of looking at different problems in quantum information, and vice versa, we've learned quite a lot in condensed matter from what we've seen in quantum information. So for example, we've seen already in this workshop how symmetry-protected topological phases of matter can be used for resources for measurement-based quantum computation. We've had talks by Akimasa, Robert, and we'll have one later today by Suchi. And they're really the symmetry has given us a way to look at the problem of finding resources for measurement-based quantum computation in a very structured way. And then on the other hand, we've learned in doing so, we've discovered a lot of new symmetry-protected topological phases, and that has been interesting in its own right. And then there's another connection here, which is to fault-tolerant logic. So in particular, this problem of trying to find transversal gates or locality-preserving gates for topological codes, there's been a lot of work that connects this deeply with these phases with symmetry. So these two references here, Heinrich and Cheng, they show that certain symmetry-enriched topological phases can be used to construct transversal gates. So for instance, they come up with a surface code phase, a toric code phase of matter, where they have a transversal Hadamard. And so we can learn quite a lot there. And then on the other hand, we have these works by Yoshida, by Benny, where he finds that when you're in trying to like understand what kind of transversal gates you can have in a code, you end up constructing SPT phases of matter. And then you can turn that back around and use SPT phases of matter to construct different locality preserving gates. So there's been a variety of interesting connections here. And the one I want to talk to you today about is this different problem, which is to store quantum information. So we're going to look at how these phases with symmetry can be used to store quantum information as a quantum memory. So this problem of storing quantum information is a very old problem. And depending on who you ask, you might get a slightly different answer. So if we look at the problem from a quantum information perspective, the answer would be to use quantum error correcting codes. So we want to use redundancy. We want to encode our information into many qubits and use these extra degrees of freedom to diagnose the location of errors. And on the other hand, if you ask the condensed matter theorists, they might say you should use the ground space of a topologically ordered system, topologically ordered phase, where the long-range entanglement will protect you from errors that happen in your system if they're local. And so in both of these perspectives, we have that there's some local operators, be they Czech operators or Hamiltonian terms, and they're fixing subspace of our Hilbert space, and that's where we put our information. And then errors can be diagnosed by measuring these operators, these Czech operators or these local operators. But this measurement is pretty expensive. Doing repeated rounds of error correction is quite expensive in resources. And so there's this old problem of, can we store information without active error correction? And this is the notion of self-correction. So we have some system where errors are naturally dissipated. Harmful errors don't build up in your system, and you can protect your information for a long time. And so today, I'll talk about two different aspects. The talk will be divided into two parts. The first part is really building on what Stephen was saying. And so we're going to show how you can find self-correcting quantum memories, provided you have some symmetry. And the idea here is really just to understand what's going on in these systems. So we don't expect this symmetry to necessarily be something physically realistic, but we want to understand the mechanisms and then use that to guide ourselves forward to try and find systems where they might realize these symmetries or the behavior of these systems might mimic these symmetry-protected memories. So the first part will be explaining this model here. It doesn't matter. This Rausendorff model that Stephen alluded to. And then the second part will be this more open-ended part, this ongoing work, where we study a 3D gauge color code phase. So the outline is, the first part, I'll just give a bit of background on self-correction and some of the no-go results that make this a non-trivial problem. There's many experts here, so they know more than me, for sure. And they, in fact, pioneered this field. Then the second part will be exploring this notion of what is a symmetry-protected quantum memory, what are the rules, and an example that satisfies these rules. And then the third part will be just some early steps on finding phases of matter in subsystem codes. So this is kind of the high-level picture of what a self-correcting memory should look like. It's really motivated from this great Dennis et al. Paper. So we're considering encoding the information in the ground space of some many-body spin system. And then errors give rise to these excitations. And the idea is that there should be some phase, if we have the temperature low enough, then all of these excitations are confined, all of these errors are confined, and they don't build up. And in the limit of infinitely large system size, our ground space information will be protected perfectly. Then in the high temperature phase, these excitations form long objects that traverse the whole lattice, and there our information is destroyed. So this confining picture has been quite useful in guiding us to what we want in a physical system that should be self-correcting. And this can all be really more precisely formalized by the so-called Caltech rules, which is what some people use to refer to these rules. So there's five real conditions. The first one is that we want a spin system in three dimensions or less, where we have local dimension is finite, and there's a finite density of these guys. Then we have some local Hamiltonian, so each term acts on some ball of bounded radius, and its strength has to be finite as well. Then we require that there's a degenerate ground space, so either that has to be exact in the infinite limit, but there could be some small splitting in the finite system size, and this ground space should be perturbatively stable, so it shouldn't be finely tuned. And then this next condition is the important one, which is that the lifetime should grow in the system size. So when we couple this system to an environment at some temperature, the lifetime should diverge and preferably exponentially in the system size. Then finally, we want to have an efficient classical decoder, because in the end, when we want to read out our information, we'll still need to do one round of error correction, perhaps, to diagnose the errors and then do a readout. And so the open problem is, can such a system exist? In particular, can it exist in three dimensions or less? And this has been the topic of much debate. And then I've heard that perhaps these Caltech rules are actually formulated by David. So maybe they should be called the Balan laws or something. And this is a picture that was on the board just outside. So maybe you need to update your perimeter. Yeah, it's fine. And so what's the mechanism that really gives rise to self-correction? Because this condition of trying to diagnose the memory time when you're coupled to a thermal bath is a pretty messy problem. We want to come up with some nice heuristic or some nice quantifier of this, or proxy for it. And that's the energy barrier. So this is the minimal energy cost that needs to be traversed to implement a logical operator when you're using only local operations. So you imagine that the noise in a system should happen in a local way. And so as this noise builds up, you build up some energy in the system, you require some energy, and you want this to be large, because then you're protecting this transition by the Boltzmann factor. So this is leads to the phenomenological law of the Arrhenius law, and this is what has been observed for some systems. Not always true, but it's a good guiding intuition, which is that if you have an energy barrier of delta, then the memory time grows exponentially in delta over t when you're below some critical temperature. As I said, this law is not always true, but at least in terms of the energy barrier, this is a growing energy barrier. So you want the energy barrier to grow with the system size. And this is a necessary condition for stabilizer Hamiltonians. So Tem and Castorariano have done the hard work there. And they show that you really do need a growing energy barrier if you want to have a growing memory time. And this is only an upper bound, actually. So they show that you can relate the energy barrier to an upper bound on the mixing time, which is the time taken for your state to get nearly to a Gibbs state. Once you're at a Gibbs state, you have no information of the original state left. And so this gives the general folklore of the no strings rule. So you don't want to have string operators in your code, because whenever you have a string operator, you can consider some finite segment of that string operator, string logical operator, and there's only going to be violations at the boundary. So there's only going to be excitations on the boundary of this string. So you can propagate this string and get a logical operator with only a constant energy cost. So people typically look for codes that have no string logical operators. So then this problem of can there be a self-correcting quantum memory in 3D, really people just try and find models that have a macroscopic energy barrier. So by macroscopic, I just mean that the energy barrier grows with the system size. And so the classical example, the classicalizing example, is this 2D Ising model, and it's a classical memory. This really illustrates what the energy barrier is all about. So you imagine you have some classical spins, some 0 or 1, on each of the plaquettes of a 2D square lattice. And there's going to be some Ising coupling between neighboring faces that wants them to align. So there's two ground states here. There's the all zeros and the all one state. And if you want to go from the all zero state to the all one state, say, you're going to have to create some domain wall of flip spins. And the energy cost is on the boundary of this droplet. So you create some region of flip spins. And then on the boundary of that, you have a domain wall. And there's an energy cost proportional to that domain wall. And you're going to have to sweep this domain wall across the whole lattice. So you end up going through some state here in the middle where you have about order L terms that are flipped. And so your energy barrier there is proportional to L. And then correspondingly, you can show that the energy barrier, sorry, the lifetime of this classical memory grows exponentially with the system size, with the length. And so people have looked for these models, the quantum versions of these models, and it turns out to be quite tough. So the 2D toric code, while it's a good error-correcting code, it's not self-correcting, it has string-like logicals, and so it has a constant energy barrier. And independently, it's been shown that the lifetime is constant in the system size. Similarly, with the 3D toric code, this also has a string-like logical. And then it seems like you kind of need to go to four dimensions, at least in the stabilizer case, to get self-correction. So you can look at the 4D toric code, which has a pair of 2D logical operators. So the energy barrier there is order L, and the lifetime grows exponentially in L. And so there's been a bunch of no-go results that say looking for these models is tough. So I would say that the 2D stabilizer case is pretty much out. There's a number of results that say your logical operators always have a string-like logical operator. So it can't be self-correcting. Then similarly, if you go to the commuting projector case, David has shown that then again, there in that situation as well, if you have topologically ordered 2D commuting projector, then you have a constant energy barrier as well. Then this wide class of stabilizer models, which what people typically think about, which is this 3D stabilizer models that have translational invariance and scale invariance, which means that the ground space dimension doesn't grow with the system size. Those guys also have string-like logicals, so they're not self-correcting. And then this other result here, where if you have a non-Clifford gate in a 3D stabilizer code, then you necessarily have a string-like logical as well. And there's many more results. So it's a hard landscape. But what we should be doing is taking a lesson from topological order. So topological ordered systems provide good codes because they're robust to perturbations. The ground states can't be distinguished by local operators. There's many different definitions of topological order, but all of them require long-range entanglement of the ground states. That means we might as well take that as our definition. So we say a state at zero temperature, meaning just a unique state, we say a state is topologically ordered if we can't prepare it from with a low-depth circuit. And low-depth is kind of what you choose it to be, is either constant, perhaps log, but we say it's topologically ordered if you need a linear depth to prepare that state. And so that's for ground states, but we know that if we're coupling to some environment, we're not spending all of the time in the ground space, but we should be in some mixture of the low energy states. And so we should really be looking at the topological order of say a thermal state, the Gibbs state. And we say that this Gibbs state is topologically ordered if we can't prepare it from the Gibbs state of a classical Gibbs state with a low-depth circuit. And a classical Gibbs state is the Gibbs state of some Hamiltonian that has all terms diagonal in some local basis. And so that definition is due to Hastings. And we can ask, OK, what systems are topologically ordered at non-zero temperature? And it turns out we don't know any 3D models either that are topologically ordered. So the fractal models, such as Haar's cubic code, they were promising candidates, and as well as Courtney's fractal codes, fractal product codes. Those guys are all marginally self-correcting, but they don't have topological order. And moreover, all of these 3D stabilizer and translationally and scale invariant models also have no topological order. So if we're looking for models that should be self-correcting, maybe we should be trying to find models that have topological order first. And that's why we look to these symmetry-protected topological phases, because we know of examples in dimensions 3 that have topological order at non-zero temperature. And so that's the goal now, is to understand the stability of these phases. And then in part 2, we'll try to replicate the stability in phases without needing any symmetry. So briefly, what is a SPT phase, symmetry-protected topological phase? It's the same definition as topological order, but with a symmetry constraint. So we say a ground state is SPT ordered if we can't prepare it from the product state with a low-depth circuit, where all of the gates in this circuit commute with the symmetry. And then you can formulate that for the Gibbs state as well. It's the same definition, but with this symmetry constraint. And then these phases, they fall into these two categories, so these symmetric phases. So there's symmetry-enriched topological phases and symmetry-protected topological phases. And these are distinguished by what their entanglement is when you remove the symmetry. So in particular, these SPT phases, if you, in the absence of symmetry, you can prepare all of the ground states there from a constant depth circuit. So it's really only the symmetry that's forcing you to use this linear depth circuit. And these guys, correspondingly, they don't have anything really interesting going on in the bulk. They don't have any anionic excitations like you would have in a topological phase. They have a unique ground state whenever you don't have boundaries, so it doesn't depend on the genus, say. On the other hand, these symmetry-enriched topological phases, they're topological in their own right, even without the symmetry. So the states are long-range entangled. And then in the symmetry, with a symmetry constraint, they also fall into different equivalence classes. And so this is kind of the rough table here, where you can have these four different categories where you have either long-range entanglement or you have symmetry. The four different combos, that's what we call them, trivial, SPT, SCT, or just regular topological phases. And interestingly, these SPT phases do have interesting properties when you consider them on a lattice with a boundary. So when you have a lattice with a boundary, you always have to have some non-trivial state on the boundary. So it either has to be gapless, could be symmetry breaking, or if it's not those two, then it has to be topologically ordered. And so that's the setup that we're really going to be considering, these SPT phases with some interesting topological phase on the boundary. So we're going to modify the Polan laws to consider self-correction in the presence of symmetry. So we still have these same original conditions of finite density of spins, local Hamiltonian, degenerate ground space. But then we're going to replace this condition on the growing lifetime with one in terms of the symmetry. So we want to have a macroscopic symmetric energy barrier. So now the local operations that you do to implement a logical error, they have to commute with this symmetry. Of course, we still have the classical decoder. And then we have to have this extra condition, which makes sure we're not imposing too strong a symmetry, which is that we have to have a symmetric encoding circuit. So we need to be able to take our state, arbitrary state, and then write down an encoding circuit where all of the gates commute with the symmetry. And so I think Stephen already talked about this a bit with his toy examples, which is that this constraint on requiring a symmetric encoding circuit means that you can't do too stupid a thing. So some examples that you can't have a 2D stabilizer model where you just promote all of your stabilizers to symmetries, then you have no way of encoding. And then similarly with these Benny models, these stabilizer models with translational invariance and scale invariance. Okay, so the requirement here of having a symmetric encoding circuit really requires that if we look at the Pauli logical operators, they must all admit a symmetric local decomposition, which means you can build them up from a sequence of local operators where all of these operators commute with the symmetry. Okay. So can these things exist? The answer is yes. And we use this model originally due to Rausendorf, Barbie, and Harrington. So I just call the RBH model or the Rausendorf model, the model that keeps on giving. So really what we have here is we have this 3D cluster model in the bulk. I don't want to go into like too specific details of the Hamiltonian and the symmetries because I'll define the gauge color code later and I don't want to overload the models. But we have this Rausendorf model in the bulk, which is a cluster state. We have on the boundary a toric code phase that has these additional dressing. So you have the normal toric code, but then the X star term also has these dangling Zs into the bulk. That turns out to be important. And that 2D phase on the boundary commutes with all of the bulk terms as well. And then we have this subsystem symmetry that's known as a one-form symmetry. And so that's an example of one of the generators there. All of the generators look like product of Pauli X on some closed two-dimensional surface. And we have them for every surface. This is another example of a subsystem symmetry that we've seen quite a few examples of already. And so this model has this trivial bulk. There's no degeneracy in the bulk. It's a unique state. But then all of the degeneracy is localized on the boundary on this toric code phase. So the picture will really be that this information is encoded on the boundary, and it's protected by the bulk and the symmetry. And so Stephen already talked about this model a bit. So I'll just mention what are the three main properties that we're looking for here moving forward in looking in the subsystem case. So there's these three main lemmas, really, that give us the result that it's self-correcting. So the first one, which I'll go into all of these three in a minute, but the first one says that all of the bulk excitations form collections of loops. So this is these closed loops. So this is a condition based on the one-form symmetry. So the one-form symmetry demands that all of the excitations form closed loops. And then below some critical temperature, they'll all be confined. The second lemma states that on the boundary, we can have these anionic excitations in the surface code phase. But they can only exist if they're accompanied by some bulk excitation that terminates there. So the bulk and boundary excitations are coupled based on the symmetry. And then thirdly, as a result of these previous two, if you want to implement, if you consider some logical fault happening from local noise, you're required to create some anionic excitations and then move them apart. And then there must be some point at which there's a separation of all these anions of order L. And then since all these anions must be accompanied by some bulk loop-like excitations which are confined, there's going to be some large energy cost for going through such a configuration. So this guy will have some polynomial energy barrier. So a little bit more carefully what these things are. So on the lattice level, this is what the one-form symmetry generators look like. You have one for every tree cell and one for every vertex. Here, these guys generate all two-dimensional closed surfaces that can be contracted to a point. And the picture is that all of the excitations in the Rausendorf model, they look like they can be formed from products of Pauli Z. So if you have some string of Pauli Z coming into one of these closed two-dimensional surfaces, then it must also leave that surface in order to commute with the symmetry. So that's why all of these excitations must form closed loops. And here's some example of what they look like just there. And then below some critical temperature, I mean, whether these loops proliferate or not depends on one, they have some large energy cost. So like a loop, the energy cost of a loop depends on its length. And so large loops are energetically suppressed, but then there's also an entropic addition, which is that, or competition, which is that large loops are entropically favorable. And so there's some trade-off there, and then below some critical temperature, the energetic suppression wins out, and these loops are all confined. The second part is this boundary coupling. So symmetry is on the boundary. There's many ways of seeing why this anionic coupling to the bulk must happen in the presence of symmetry. And one way is to just look at the boundary terms and the bulk terms and notice that symmetry operators look like products of the boundary terms and the bulk terms. So if that symmetry operator must be preserved, then a flipped boundary term must be accompanied by a flipped bulk term. And then this flipped bulk term then must like continue off as it must be some closed loop. And so here's an example. If you wanted to have some string operator on the boundary, this Pauli Z that creates two anionic excitations, these E's there, they must be accompanied by some loop in the bulk. And then finally, to create some logical operator on the boundary, we still have the usual string-like operators, but just the X1 has this dressing into the bulk. We want to create this logical operator. A simple case is to just imagine trying to directly create one of these logical operators. So you start by creating some small string segment, and you get a pair of anionic excitations, and then they must be accompanied by some bulk loop. And then you imagine growing this string to traverse the lattice, and then that will implement your logical operator. And so in the middle, this is kind of what you would see from the perspective of the energetics. You would see some anions that live at the end of some bulk loop, and then that would have to traverse the lattice to get a logical operator. And you can show that this is generally the case. So they're the three properties that we're looking for. We have some bulk confinement. This is determined from the symmetry. We have some bulk boundary coupling, which is a property of the symmetry, but as well as the SPT order of the bulk. So you don't get this coupling in the trivial phase. And then there's some energy costs for creating separated anions. And you can see this kind of, there's other examples of these symmetry protected memories, including some walkaway models. It would be interesting to see like how general that is. Okay, so before I move to the second part, just a little summary of that, this first part, which is that self-correction is possible when in the presence of symmetry. But these symmetries are particularly strong. They're these subsystem symmetries, known as one-form symmetries. And so we want to look at how to realize this mechanism in some more physically realistic model without requiring this symmetry explicitly. And so here's a table of just some subset of the known results, which you can correlate the notion of topological order at non-zero temperature with self-correction. So there's no like proof that you need to be topologically ordered to be self-correcting or vice versa, but here's just some independent results, and they seem to correlate nicely. So it would be nice to formalize that connection more precisely. Okay, so part two, we're going to study a phase of the gauge color code to try and replicate these features. And so the gauge color code is a natural candidate for a self-correcting quantum memory. It has like a very strong sense of confinement in many different senses. So when it has the single shot error correction, which is necessary to have a self-correcting quantum memory. But the physics of this model is pretty poorly understood, mainly because it's a useful Hamiltonian that you try to write down is in general going to be frustrated. So solving this model is hard. So that's going to be our goal, to try and write down some reasonable Hamiltonian and see what it looks like, try and study it. And so the gauge color code is an example of a subsystem code first introduced by David. So a subsystem code is where you take your normal notion of a subspace code, like a stabilizer code, and then you only encode information in a subsystem of this subspace. So you imagine this bottom section here is the code space of some stabilizer code, and then you just call some of your degrees of freedom gauge degrees of freedom, and you don't care about what they're doing. You don't care about their state. You only care about the information in this logical subsystem. And it turns out this is quite helpful in a variety of aspects. And so these guys are, you can specify a subsystem code by some gauge group. So this gauge group is some subset of the Pauli group. It doesn't have to be abelian. And it generates, you should think about this gauge group is generating all of the Pauli maps between these gauge degrees of freedom. Okay, and then you can find the stabilizer group in the center of this gauge group up to some choice of sign. So in general, there's no unique choice of sign. But you just choose some signs for your stabilizers, and then that's your stabilizer group. And this stabilizer group then specifies this whole code space here. Then there's two types of logical operators. There's bare logical operators, which are all the Pauli operators that commute with all of your gauge operators. So they don't, they only act on your logical subsystem. They preserve the state of the gauge degrees of freedom. And then you can also consider dress logical operators. So these act on both the logical and gauge subspace. And the idea there is that these operators can be just as good because you don't care about your gauge degrees of freedom. And the gauge color code is a particular example, first introduced by Hector Bombin. So this model, you have qubits on the vertices of some four colorable. So four, like you can color the three cells of the lattice with four colors, such that no neighboring three cells share a color. And the lattice also has to be four valent. And then on such a lattice, such as this one depicted here, which is from Brown, Nickerson, and Brown, you have gauge generators on all of the faces. So you have Z plaquettes and X plaquettes. So that's the tensor product of all X on all of the qubits that belong to some face, similarly for Z. And on this particular lattice, there's two types of gauge operators. There's the squares and the hexagons. Then you look at the stabilizers. These are the operators that belong to the gauge group and commute with all of the other gauge operators. They're given by operators on three cells, and they take the form of cubes and soccer balls. And then when you consider it on some lattice that has the topology of a three ball, such as this tetrahedron here, you get a single logical qubit. And the bare logical operators look like these 2D objects, and you can push this bare logical operator onto any one of the facets of the tetrahedron. And then you can also dress this operator to get some string like dressed logical operators. So this is kind of a high level picture of what the logical operator support looks like. And that's for both X and Z. So choosing such a Hamiltonian that represents this phase is, there's no unique choice. Like in the stabilizer case, you can just take, say, minus the sum of a generating set of stabilizers. Here, there's no obvious choice. So the question really is, write down the model that you think you can solve and that represents best the physics of the model, the physics of the code. So Thomas and I were looking at this model, and we decided to write such a Hamiltonian down. So we only take sum of all of the hexagonal gauge terms. And immediately, it doesn't seem like why you should do this, but in terms of the lattice, there's quite a nice structure there. All of these hexagonal terms live on 1D lines. So you have a bunch of terms that all live on all of these hexagonal faces form like a cubic honeycomb across the lattice. And we call each one of those a gauge chain. So here's highlighted there is like some of the terms that belong to the Hamiltonian. And then we also add some stabilizers to the Hamiltonian as well, fix out some degeneracy. And so understanding what this model is doing, well, each one of these chains, these gauge chains, which is a sum of all these hexagonal terms along some one-dimensional direction, they all commute with every other stabilizer, and they all commute with every other chain. So the only anti-commutation relations live within gauge chains. And so we encode this relation in what's known as a frustration graph. So this graph is formed by putting a vertex for every term and then an edge between two vertices whenever their corresponding terms anti-commute. And in terms of this model, the frustration graph is just a bunch of different line graphs. And there's no product constraints amongst any of the terms. You can't product up any of the gauge terms and the stabilizers to get the identity. And to solve this model, we map it to a bunch of different 1D models that are well known called the XY model. And they're solvable by a free fermion mapping. I think I'm running out of time a bit, so I might just try and go through very quickly. So we can formalize this more precisely by saying this model that we wrote down is actually dual, unitarily equivalent to a bunch of different independent 1D XY models. And these are well known, so we can use this to solve our model. And each one of these chains you can think of as a small subsystem code that encodes one logical with distance one into n qubits. So it's pretty bad code, but it helps us understand the physics. And so the first thing to note is that the ground space of this Hamiltonian is exactly equal to the code space of the Hamiltonian. And via this mapping, we can deduce where the gapped and gapless points are. So it's gapped everywhere away from the equal strength point where it's gapless. The errors on this model in the gauge color code look like string operators, and they cause syndromes on their boundary. So the idea is we want to see what are the energetics of these string operators, and whether they're confined or not. And so, because I'm out of time, I'll just say that the upshot is that yes, the string operators are confined in the bulk. You look at what the cost of some string operator is, and it grows with the length of the string. But the gauge color code, you need these non-trivial boundary conditions. So you can't consider the bulk alone. You need to consider on a lattice with a boundary. And when you consider the lattice with a boundary, this bulk confinement kind of fails a bit. You can find these pathological paths which have low energy costs and implement a logical fault. The idea is that As you start propagating one of these string operators, say along the boundary, it creates a bunch of gauge violations, so it costs a bunch of energy. But then this energy can be propagated along each one of these 1D chains, and then it can hit the other boundary and then dissipate.
Was it not possible to put out a torus or something?
So it turns out that the gauge color code on a torus has no logical qubits. It's kind of quite mysterious, but if you look at the kind of logical operators that you'd expect, say like membranes supported on some non-contractible two-cycle, then that operator belongs to the gauge group. So it's not, yeah. So there's these faults that couple all of the boundaries, and they can be implemented with a low energy cost. And really, this is because we hadn't considered adding any Hamiltonian terms to the boundary just yet. So we have some bulk confinement. We have this bulk energy cost to separating errors. But then really, the boundary is just like some place where energy can be freely destroyed and created. And that's really the problem. So really, what we're going to do moving forward is look at different topologies and geometries, and then consider different Hamiltonians that can be put on the boundary while retaining the exact solvability. I'll just leave it there then. Thanks for listening.
We have time for a couple of questions.
So you learned about the gap of your Hamilton cubic model.
Yep.
You assume purely boundary conditions there?
No, that's the case with the open boundary conditions. Yeah. But actually, it shouldn't matter too much because the boundary contributions only add like a small correction to anything, so it's for both cases.
So a couple of years ago, Amalas wrote a sequence of papers where he was proposing coupling the surface of to some 3D ball.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of reminds me of this, and we had criticize this approach because like it was not stable against perturbation.
Mm-hmm.
But now I wonder if you revisited this model, if you impose a symmetry, maybe you could argue that these models become robust in the
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think you guys even state this in the paper somewhere, maybe, that, you know, if you restrict the kind of perturbations that you can allow, for sure, maybe
so
the system.
So there are relations between here and his work? I mean, can you say that he's just going to filter
I would like to say that, but I can't. Yeah, I don't know precisely, but that, yeah, conceptually, they're both very similar things. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Sam.
Thank you.